Mr. James, reel 25.
So discipline became...
It was noticeable. It was noticeable. Probably the RSM had got all sergeants together and told them that things were now going to be different. And they all agreed on that, but it was noticeable to me because some of them are getting bossy and nasty.
Can you remember which ones? Which ones in particular?
The senior ranks, the warrant officers, were certainly getting a little bit now, you know.
What about Georgie Broadhead? Because you said he was one of the more...
Well, the old George was a nice chap, but and he was a good soldier, a regular soldier. He wasn't to be, but he was certainly, you know... right, come on, let's have you. No messing now. And you only say it once. And the look was different as well. There was a sternness by everybody. I noticed that as soon as we arrived at this railhead. God, you know.
Can you remember any of your fellow NCOs having had battle experience before?
No.
Were there any of them were veterans of...
No. Apart from some of the old Beds and Hearts chaps with the medal up, who had no first front of their experience.
And who would that be?
Nearly all the Beds and Hearts old sweats pre-war had one of these purple and green medals, you know, which was the medal from the service in India. And those who had been out there and who had been involved in action and in the campaign, there was a campaign. So they were a sprinkling of those things.
And was no detectable difference in their attitude to the...
No.
What about your officers? I mean, where were they on the train? Can you remember?
Didn't see them. Can't remember them. Except at Gardimore.
And what happened there?
We arrived in the morning. It was in the middle of the night. And it was raining steroids. And we were aroused and many were sleeping. Right, we're here, you know, and there was the hubbub and deep saying, get out. And you all had FSMO on. And I remember particularly as well, in addition to the field service marching order, the small pack on your back, you had your gasket rolled back. And the straps are coming down the front here. And the gas mask is there. And you were told it was perfect out of day, it was terrible, black as ink, and steroids. Oh God, this railhead. We were where I detrained, but in the open. Found later that they were sort of tunnels and whatnot, but we were in the open. And we were told that it was going to be some hours before the transport would come to pick us up to take us away from Dardanelle. Meanwhile, we were to unfurl our gas capes, put our ground sheets on this marshy, wet grass, lie down on the ground sheet, and get the gas cape over you, and try and get some sleep because we'd be needing it, waiting for the troop carrying vehicles who would be coming to take us up to the front line. Now, we didn't know what the hell the front line was going to be. We didn't know how long, but we were told that it would journey to quite a long way. And, of course, since then, I've looked at the maps and I've estimated that probably the front line, Green Hill, must be at least 60 miles from Cardinal. It is quite a journey. Looking at the maps of the I suspect some of them, 60 miles was going to be a journey, but nobody knew that at the time. And it rained, I couldn't sleep awake. I couldn't sleep awake, and the officer was saying, you must get some sleep, because you'll need it. And fill your gas capes, and envelope yourselves in your gas capes, and lie on your ground sheet, back of the rain, get under there, and try and sleep. What, in a situation like that, zesty trained, feeling rotten. We feel like it's like a meal as well, but the middle of the night, raining scales in this black place. And we were glad to find that, we were glad for the dawn to come, to have some daylight at least to see what we were doing.
Were you briefed at all on where you were going to go to? Were you briefed?
Briefed? Well, we were told that we had to wait for the transport and that we would be going from here to a point where the transport would stop, and there, from there on, would be a march into the front line.
And who was telling
you? We leave the Royal West Kent.
Who was telling you this? Who was the...
Some pages had it from probably the officers. I don't know, but we would the news spread generally.
So the sergeant majors would have had a.
He was heading the platoon sergeants, and still the officers were sort of away from us, you know. But we were told anyway that the front line wasn't far away, and that we'd be lifted from this place by transport to a place where there would be a march in to relieve the Royal West Kents, and the bus, of course, is the same regiment. I mean, RWK is the Royal West Kents as well.
And so, talk us through that. You got on the trucks.
Actually, that's right. I myself had to link up with BFG, being a CQMS, the quartermaster's group. So, by the time everyone was on the move, we stopped at the Echelon Rendezvous, which is near Saint-Germain. And
the rest of the troops?
And the troops marched from there on, which must have been, I would think, 4 or 5 miles, it appeared, to be anyway, when I went up with the ground every night, it was about a 4 or 5 mile journey to the trenches and Green Hill and Baldy.
So you stopped at
BX Long with the
and
cooks.
What happened then specifically to you?
With us. That's right. Let me say, I can't remember when we had food in a particular sort of morning or day because it's a long time.
But where did you stop at? And what can you describe?
Yes.
What the situation?
Where we stopped at again, said your name. We were with Bert Newman and his compound rations. That's where they had compound rations, boxes of tinned food and biscuits. 14 men to a box, or one box for a man for 14 days. There were two different sorts. One had steak and kidney pudding, which was marvellous. These steak and kidney puddings were great. But snag was with the steak and kidney pudding, the sweets were not the best. The afters were inferior. But with the McConaughey's, the afters were super. They were good.
What were the afters in what were the afters in the McConaughey's?
Tins of Greek fruit salad was some. And rice pudding in others, cream rice pudding, as far as I remember. You know, we all love the cream rice pudding, it was marvelous. And we all love the steak and kidney puddings, but the cream rice pudding wasn't with the steak and kidney pudding.
So when you had the steak and kidney pie, what was the afters with that? When you had the steak and kidney pie, the nice steak and kidney pie, what was wrong with the afters?
Fabulous. Pastry was wonderful. It enveloped the most luscious, delicious, lean, tender beef and kidney, steak kidney. And what you used to do is to get your jackknife and punch a hole in it and put water and get yourself at certain times. But when I went up to the line every night with Grant for the whole company, they were all opened and heated, preheated by the cooks, and taken up in these big, heavy steel containers. which were kept piping hot, boiling hot sometimes, in outer sealed vacuum cases, boxes, so that the grub, they would carry it around and it would be boiling hot, wouldn't lose any heat at all.
Could you describe that nightly supply run? How would that work?
Every night. You could smell the North African heather. It smelled to me like coal bags. Have you ever spent, when you get a coal merchant delivering coal in very, very thick sacks, which were returnable, the sacks had that smell. It was bad, it was so sweet. But the smell of the heather and the plants that were growing pervaded the whole, lovely smell going through the countryside. And when the moon was full, the blackness was like the moon. And so it was like the moon. It was artificial, sometimes they made artificial moonlight. But we, anyway, on our very first night, should never forget going up to the front line with the club to D Company today. And I realized that each company had a couple of quarters in tunnels there, because it was near a railway sort of place. But the troop, we inherited the trenches forsaken by the brigades. I suppose they took over from previously from the Baths and the Argyles and so on. But anyway, it was a static situation, and Green Hill was there looming. There it was. You could see it in the moonlight, and you knew the jails were there. And you never knew when the jail was thrown up there. We didn't mean there any jail growth. We sent patrols out, but we didn't get jail growth out last. But anyway, there was shelling as well, and one had to be very careful. Because the moonlight would be reflected in the truck's windscreens. And if they saw, they'd kill us. And if this is our first experience of being under fire. And that was the sky. We'd see it like moonlight nights as providers of grub. We liked dark nights without the moon.
And what was this nightly convoy? How many trucks would you have?
So there would be one truck per company, a 1,500 truck, which is a small truck. One driver and a seat direct in the front, with his rifle. I used to sit beside the driver with one up the spout. And if anybody sort of dashed out, he had it. And I was ready to shoot anybody who came on. I had one up the spout with a safety catch on. Going up to the line.
What was the road like?
It was a rough. The truck bounced and wobbled up over the. The ruts. It was just a rough stone. Well, I couldn't have been bloody road. We made a road eventually by using it so often, you know. But it was a typical mountainous, rough road. And I don't think anybody made any attempt to fill in any holes or whatever, or make it better. And we didn't know we'd be there. And besides, you get through there by day because you'd get shot at. I can't get those of you in a car. You'd be shot at. But you see, you didn't show yourself in the day. But at night time, as I say, you went up in the dark.
And how long would this journey take?
Oh, it's only about 4 or 5 miles. It would take roughly about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, we'd be there.
And what time would you set off?
This was January, and it was winter, even there, dark early. And we set off roughly about 5 o'clock, as a mail, 5 o'clock for the evening meal of the troops. And it was piping hot, and there was plenty of it.
And you drove towards Green Hill. How far would you get in the truck?
So we were then, there was a stopping point for the trucks. Not too far from the trenches, because the grub had been manhandled from the trucks. Maybe, let me see, shall we say, maybe 100 yards to the trenches, and we would be there in the front line pushing it out. And the troops would be coming one by one, not killing up. And he'd have his ration, and the next one would be behind him, and he'd go back to their positions. And he'd serve everybody down, and he'd get damn good helping. He'd have two restings, two halves, and his mug for tea. And he'd first of all have his grub, then he'd come back for his tea with his bacon, with their two hands. And then we would silently dish it out. And we'd hear about whether they were shelled that day, and there was spasmodic shelling. Sometimes there were nothing, sometimes they had, you know, sometimes more than 30 shells, and sometimes. But there were shell holes everywhere. And the jellies would lob a shell over. I'm not sure whether the jellies were challenged there, but some say they were both. And they would shell quite frequently. And this was static.
So,
but you had shell fire.
So this would be a routine that you'd have to do every night?
Every night.
And would this be the only meal that the troops would have in the front line?
Hot.
The only hot meal.
That's right.
So would you also have delivered compo rations?
But
yes, cold.
What happened was, in the tunnel there was a stock of compo rations, a special store for emergency, and it was emergency rations, and. For the whole of the battalion in the line, for four companies, ABCB, in the line. And they had this built-up stock delivered there. It wasn't before we arrived, but Bert Milman, I don't know who authorized it or what it was for, but I rather think it might have been a jumping off place, and we thought that perhaps we'd have some reserve food there. It was taken catch of the Germans, incidentally. But anyway, there was a big stock there, and it was to be kept intact, although I mean we were aware of the chances there were some boxes that were stuck.
And some of the other veterans have complained about how the combo ration box, although this is probably later, the combo ration boxes were like they'd lose their cigarettes and they'd lose. You know,
the compo boxes were sealed, they were well sealed, I can tell you that, and there was tins of cigarettes in there, you see. And,
we should have gone through the contents, can we just go through the contents of the typical box?
As far as I can remember, you had, that's right, you had the luxury box with steak kidney pudding, and the other box was bully beef. Cold bully beef. But with a cold bully beef, you had rice pudding. But with the steak and kidney pudding, you had some inferior sweet.
And what were the other ingredients, or the other elements in the box besides
those? In the box, you'd have tins of beans as well, tins of sweets, tea, cigarettes, bacon. That was for the breakfast. The tin bacon was really delicious and wonderful. You know, it funny enough, it was streaky mainly, and it was sort of transparent, but it was delicious. And as far as I remember, anyway, it's tin bacon and tins of vegetables. Massive oil, you know, all chopped up, carrots and stuff like that, potatoes, you know, diced potatoes, so on and so forth.
And then you said there was a tin of cigarettes as well.
A tin of cigarettes, that's right.
And I'm on that.
And the cigarettes, when it did the 50, they were round tins. And I forget how many tins were in there, but anyway, they were there in every box, sealed, so that you'd you had the top of the tin. First of all, you took the top of the tin, and you had a little brass sort of spike in the lid of the tin. The tin itself had a pretty fancy end, and on the top was a sealed thin metallic skin. And you dug your top cover spike into the thin skin and twisted it. And so you broke the seal, and the fangs were there. Marvellous, you know, beautiful. 55 meter. Everybody smoked.
And did you smoke at this time then?
Sorry?
You smoked at this time?
I smoked. I didn't smoke early in the army, but I spied one or something like that. A Penny Churchman was in which he put the stage in the city street. But I didn't smoke, but I could afford it. But in the army, at Bedford, 45 minutes periods, and then fall out for a smoke. You soon smoked. Everybody smoked. Every soldier smoked.
So the ration run would be as much to deliver the cigarettes to the front line as to deliver.
We had, I think, eventually. I mean, you had your tins of cigarettes in the box. There were also tins of tobacco for the pipe smokers. And as far as I remember, anyway, there was those fags in the box were for 14 men, and so you only had three. 3 14s to 42, maybe 8 left over, wouldn't it? You know, and so you had a fag, you know, you had 3 fags on that box. Apart from that, you had the opportunity to have, I think you were also given from time to time, tins of 50.
Where were you actually billeted in Saginaw, and what was your impressions of Saginaw at this time?
It was a village that had been occupied by the Cherries. They knew all about Saginaw. They had occupied it before they were knocked out by the British, you know, in the early part of November. There were evidence in Germany, and they knew evidence in Saginaw. But the big thing that I can remember was the tobacco factory was empty. It was two corrugated iron buildings with corrugated iron roofs. And it was on a hill. And there was the top one, the bank, and the second one. And sliding doors. The hill wasn't too steep, but there was a sort of a mezzanine affair, you understand what I mean? The bottom one had a bank, a loading bank, you would call it, which you could do about 6 foot high. You could jump up onto the top one. So that the inside of the two buildings was all open. But from outside, you had to be two separate buildings. And that was used by us. And the Arabs passing by knew that we were occupying this damn place. We used it for sleeping. We used it for just coming back for getting deloused and things like that. And for the case of bath or wash. You know, and it was in full use. I think myself that was there were other buildings. Bert Newman was very crafty. He didn't have to live in a lovely place. He was over in the woods with trenches dug.
So where did Bert Newman base himself, and where did
where the buildings were, there were cactus outside, and across about 100 yards over there, fields and woods, that's where Bert Newman was, over there, with his trucks. He had trucks with all this.
And were they camouflaged within the woods?
Camouflaged nets, yeah. And all that sort of thing. And it was a sort of an open air store with camouflage nets and all this transport as well under cover.
And so, where would you sleep on a night then? Where would?
Well, sometimes I would sleep in a truck sometimes.
And normally?
There was a 30 underweight truck. And that was very comfortable in the back, you know. It was unloaded, you see, there. And that was quite a good place. I also slept in that cigarette factory on the concrete floor.
So, at Bay Eglon, there would be the CQMSs of the four rifle companies.
All together.
And who else would be based there?
The CQMSs of the four rifle companies, the Bert Newman and his staff and stores, and that was B. Echelon. The B. Echelon people were the suppliers.
Where would the commanding officer be?
Oh, they had the county quarters.
And where would that be?
Quarters, they would be the other companies. They had the county quarters up in the front line. In a tunnel, and I remember the tunnels very well. There were lots of tunnels there. It's funny, there's a place called Sedgemay. I don't remember if it was Sedgemay, not that tunnels. At Sedgemay, I remember particularly there was another one tunnel there in Vietnam for wounded chaps. And the ambulance used to call them the meat wagons. And there was a hospital there as well, in Sedgemay.
That was in the Sedgemay tunnel, was it?
Sedgemay,
did you have any much contact with the other British units that were based there?
No, apart from the Bofors guns, ATAC, Royal Artillery, anti-aircraft. They were very close to us. And we had two Bofors guns outside this tobacco factory. In fact, civil battle would be there at the Cooks, would be at the Vietnam as well, certainly.
So the Cooks, the CQMSs?
That's right, the Cooks especially.
What about the base defence platoon that's been mentioned? Apparently, according to some of the documents, the DLI provided the base defence platoon at this stage as well.
Well, I can't remember much about that, to be honest with you.
Because the brigade headquarters apparently was there,
yes,
as well.
Probably, yes. I can't remember much about that. But it's about the real concern anyway. The Vietnam were the Cooks. And they had a company, each cook, each company cook pair, a few cooks, and Sergeant Battle was a real supervisor or not, would have their company cookouts. Do you understand? At Bierschau. And they'd be cooking for their companies and keeping their hands in. It was only when there was some consolidation, you know, when there'd be a battalion or a cookhouse. But usually there were company cookhouses and they were inside of each other.
What about the signallers? Did you have any signallers? Or were they further to the front?
The signallers? Yeah. They were all out with the companies. And
now, during this phase, how would you describe the relative strengths of the Air Force, of the German Air Force and the British Air Force? Did you see much of either?
We only saw the old Spitfire, and we were disappointed about that because the two German Messerschmitts. And they were, they each carried a bomb as well. And they were all, they were shy dogs. They were up there, they could see everything. You dared show yourself during the day. If they saw the least thing, you dared go out on the road and show yourself. You hid like a very slug under a stone. You hid from them. And, but they seized with the, you know, kind of like fires in this beautiful place when we were under the trees once or twice. If they saw a wisp of smoke, they came down and they riddled the whole of the bloody place. I was talking about the two, petrol up there as well, incidentally. I was carrying two jerry cans full of petrol for the cook's vehicle for the dump. And down they came and started away from Daddy Wood. I dumped the trucks and I got the other big tree. And how they missed me, I don't know, because they were just tree height. And bullets everywhere.